From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, Russian forces in Ukraine. NATO says it has clear evidence of Russian boots on the ground, bolstering the rebel fight against government troops.
These latest images provide concrete examples of Russian activity inside Ukraine, but they are only the tip of the iceberg.
Also today, new figures from the World Health Organization show the Ebola outbreak in West Africa could eventually infect more than 20,000 people. And we look at what options are left for President Obama as the Islamic State threat persists in Iraq.
The options that he seems to think are open, including military strikes, are primarily illegal, violations of international law, and almost guaranteed not to work.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko has said that Russian troops have invaded the east of the country. Mr. Poroshenko has canceled a visit to Turkey to confer with defense chiefs to discuss Kiev's response. The United Nations Security Council is holding an emergency meeting in New York to discuss the crisis. Jake Rashbass reports from Moscow.
The Ukrainian president described the rapidly deteriorating situation in the east of the country as pro-Russian rebels took over the town of Novoazovsk, threatening that their next move would be to take over the bigger port of Mariupol. NATO announced that it has been detecting a substantial rise in Russian weapons being delivered to rebels over the past 2 weeks. Russia has denied that any of its troops crossed the border into Ukraine, but one pro-Russian rebel leader in eastern Ukraine has said that 3,000 or 4,000 Russian citizens are fighting with the rebels. Jake Rashbass, Moscow.
Islamic State militants have apparently killed 250 Syrian soldiers following the capture of the airbase at Tabqa. According to the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, some 700 Syrians were able to escape, but social media shows the captured being marched into the desert and summarily shot. At the U.S. State Department, spokesperson Jen Psaki said the U.S. is continuing to consult with allies on how to stop the organization once known as the Islamic State of Iraq and Levant.
There's been no lack of evidence of the brutality of ISIL over the past several weeks and months. So with each incident, certainly it adds to the deck of brutality that they have put together, but it doesn't change our approach. We have had this ongoing approach that's going to continue to increase over the coming days and weeks.
Meanwhile, 43 United Nations peacekeepers have been detained in the Syrian area of the Golan Heights. The UN says it is very concerned about their safety after they were taken by an armed group. In the latest warning from the World Health Organization, the Ebola virus could infect 20,000 people before it's contained. With over 1,500 deaths recorded so far, it's already claimed more lives than all other Ebola outbreaks that have come before. William Denzelow reports from New York.
According to a roadmap released by the World Health Organization, it could take 6 to 9 months to contain the Ebola outbreak. Over 3,000 people are thought to be infected, but they say that in many areas of intense transmission, the actual number of cases may be 2 to 4-fold higher than that currently reported. As many medical facilities in West Africa struggle to cope with the sheer scale of the outbreak, the World Health Organization says that 40% of current infections occurred within the last 3 weeks. As fears of the virus spreading even further afield continue to grow, Nigeria has confirmed its first Ebola death outside of Lagos. William Denslow, New York.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. America's economy has rebounded more strongly than first believed in the second quarter, according to the U.S. Commerce Department. Gross domestic product, the broadest measure of the economy's health, grew at 4.2% for the second quarter, topping initial estimates and beating forecasts. Our U.S. correspondent Kate Fisher has more.
After a bleak start to the year, the U.S. economy grew slightly faster than initial estimates of 4%. The upward revision to 4.2% reflected stronger business investment than first thought. It comes after the economy had shrunk at a 2.1% annual rate at the start of the year. That was the biggest drop since the Great Recession, mainly reflecting the effects of a harsh winter that kept consumers away from shopping malls and disrupted factory production. The White House says today's revision affirms that economic growth has been strong, consistent with the recent string of solid job growth, but it said there was more work to be done to build on this momentum. Kate Fisher, Washington.
And the FBI is investigating a string of recent cyber attacks against major U.S. banks. J.P. Morgan Bank is said to be one of those targeted, potentially by Russian hackers. Nick Harper has this report.
The FBI and the U.S. Secret Services are working together to establish the scale of the problem. But it's thought as many as five major U.S. banks have been victims of cyber thieves. These attacks appear to be on a highly sophisticated scale. Unnamed security experts have reportedly said the hackers' tactics were far beyond that of ordinary criminals. The Bureau is said to be looking into whether the attacks came from Russia. Account information and other sensitive data was taken, but it's not clear if any of it has been used for financial gain. Nick Harper, New York.
And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports.
Over the past 2 weeks, we have noticed a significant escalation in both the level and sophistication of Russia's military interference in Ukraine. The satellite images released today provide additional evidence that Russian combat soldiers equipped with sophisticated heavy weaponry are operating inside Ukraine's sovereign territory.
Senior NATO officer Brigadier General Niko Tak addressing the latest twist in the Ukrainian crisis. NATO officials estimate there are now well over 1,000 Russian troops operating inside Ukraine as the country's president Petro Poroshenko cancelled a scheduled trip to Turkey today, announcing that Russian troops had entered his country. A Russian spokesperson denied any Russian troops had crossed into Ukraine, despite witness reports of tanks and armoured personnel carriers crossing the border. Jake Rashbass is in Moscow.
So Ukraine's president has said that there are Russian troops now on Ukrainian soil. This is a step further than previous accusations of Russia arming Ukrainian rebels. We're now talking about a full-blown invasion in Kiev's eyes. This is also significant because while fighting was mainly limited to the Lugansk and Donetsk regions in the east of the country, until this week, we're now seeing another front opening up in the southeast of Ukraine, along the Black Sea. This is to the east of Crimea, and the coastal town of Novoazovsk has now already been captured by the rebels, and the rebels have threatened to go to the larger port city of Mariupol. President Poroshenko was meant to be visiting Turkey today, but he's cancelled that so that he can meet with security officials in Kiev in order to discuss exactly how Ukraine should respond to this.
So what was Russia's response then to these allegations from the Ukrainian president today?
Well, as with all the accusations that Ukraine has levelled against Russia in the last few months, there's been a lot of denial coming out of Moscow. So Russia has flat out denied that any of its troops have crossed to Ukraine's border today. The speaker for Russia's state parliament has accused Poroshenko of lying. Russia's envoy to the OSCE, that's the Organization for the Cooperation and Security in Europe, has denied that any Russian troops are on Ukrainian soil. However, earlier on this week, when Kiev released footage of 10 Russian paratroopers on Ukrainian territory, Russia said that they just got lost and had crossed the border by mistake. It's worth remembering that earlier on this year, when Ukraine was accusing Russian troops of being present on the Crimean Peninsula, Russia denied that as well, saying that there was no proof. Just a few weeks after that, Russia annexed the region, so Ukraine is understandably quite worried about these alleged Russian soldiers. In addition to that, there have been numerous reports in Russian media recently, but notably this is an independent, non-state controlled media, of funerals, wounded soldiers returning from Ukrainian territory into Russia, wounded, but this is all being kept very secret. Journalists who've been investigating these secret burials have had their tires slashed. They've been chased away from cemeteries. So a lot of denial coming out of Russia.
And what reaction has there been from Europe to these latest accusations against Russia?
We haven't yet seen any coordinated response yet from Europe about today's accusations coming from Poroshenko. What we have seen, though, is individual member states of the European Union making statements of their own. So, for example, French President François Hollande has said that if it's proven that Russian soldiers are on Ukrainian soil, this would be, as he said, intolerable and unacceptable. Sweden's foreign minister has said that Russia's actions amount to an undeclared invasion and that there isn't the slightest doubt of what's happening. In terms of what the EU can do, though, about this alleged invasion, it remains unclear. The EU has already applied sanctions against Russia in the last couple of months, asset freezes, economic sanctions against the energy and financial and defense sectors. But although Ukraine's prime minister has called for Europe to freeze further assets in Russia, the European Union is likely to be cautious before doing that. Many EU states are highly dependent on Russia for gas, and with winter coming on, it's a great risk to be without Russian gas in the oncoming winter months, and that may not be something that the EU is willing to barter with.
FSN's Moscow correspondent Jake Rashbass. This is FSN Reports. Immeasurable suffering, the conclusion of a United Nations investigation which found war crimes and human rights atrocities have been carried out in Syria by both sides of the three-year-long conflict. The UN found evidence that Islamic State fighters had conducted a campaign of fear with public beheadings, crucifixions and amputations among the brutal tactics employed. The forces of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad were also condemned by the report over torture and other crimes against humanity. Before tackling the UN findings, Li Ling Tan, who is at the UN headquarters in New York, began with reports that dozens of UN peacekeepers are being held by militants in Syria.
Yes, we just received an update on that from the UN. The 43 peacekeepers detained by the armed group are Fijians from the UN Disengagement Observer Force, and they are being detained in the vicinity of El Kunatira. The 81 other peacekeepers are from the Philippines, and the UN says their movements are currently being restricted to the areas of Aruwehina and Bureka. The UN says it is trying to secure the release of the Fijian peacekeepers detained and also restore freedom of movement to the other 81 peacekeepers. Now, this includes discussions and negotiations with countries in the region and various missions, as well as officials in Fiji and the Philippines.
So, Li Ling, UN investigators say executions in public spaces have now become a common spectacle in IS-controlled areas of Syria. But what can you tell us about this so-called campaign of fear by the Islamic State?
Yes, in areas under Islamic State control, a campaign of fear and terror is persisting, being conducted regularly, and according to the UN report, Fridays, for example, are marked by public executions, amputations and lashings, and bodies are being put on display to terrorize the local population. Women are being lashed for not abiding by Islamic State dress codes, and boys as young as 10 years old are being recruited and trained at Islamic State camps. The report also states that the Islamic State has been forcibly displacing Kurdish communities in northern Syria, and as we are now also painfully aware, they've been systematically targeting journalists and media workers.
And the findings also accuse Assad's forces of war crimes and mass atrocities in Syria.
Indeed, it says that government forces in Syria have, between the months of January and July, killed hundreds of men, women and children by firing missiles and barrel bombs into civilian areas and in some cases deliberately targeting these sites. And that, according to the report, constitutes massacres. Now, 8 incidents in April may have involved the use of chemical agents, very likely chlorine. UN investigators also stated that government forces were responsible for systematic torture and deaths of detainees in prisons. And this is based on analyses of more than 25,000 photographs.
So now the UN has gathered this evidence. What is it going to do with it? What action is it actually going to take?
The intention is to use the evidence provided here based on some 480 interviews and vast amounts of documentary material chronicling the conflict. And the intention is to help build cases, to use this evidence to help launch cases with the International Criminal Court. The message the Commission of Inquiry on Syria is sending out is that these war crimes are being committed with total impunity by both sides, and they need to be taken to account, and the impunity needs to end. The hope is that the report and its evidence within it would compel the international community, such as represented by the Security Council, to take further action. If you recall, the UN had come under criticism for neglecting the Syrian crisis over the past few months. If you recall, a year ago, the Syrian crisis had dominated headlines, but then took a backseat as other crises emerged, such as over the Gaza Strip, in Iraq and Ukraine. But Syria, in recent weeks, is back in the headlines because of the increasing violence from the Islamic State militants, and also, of course, on news of the execution of Jim Foley in particular. So the international community is certainly under more pressure to act, and that is why the Security Council is currently meeting behind closed doors this session to discuss what other actions it can take.
Liling Tan at the UN headquarters in New York. And staying with the story, President Obama has met with the National Security Council, with the unrest in Iraq and Syria topping the agenda. The president is considering an expansion of US airstrikes against IS targets in Syria. It would follow his earlier authorization of targeted US airstrikes in northern Iraq. For more on Mr. Obama's options, FSN's Washington correspondent Lorna Shaddock spoke to journalist, activist and political commentator Phyllis Bennis.
Well, the problem that I see is that the options that he seems to think are open, including military strikes, are primarily illegal, violations of international law, and almost guaranteed not to work. Having said that, I think that what he sees as the open options are airstrikes of some sort, significant escalation in the existing arming of the Syrian opposition, and perhaps some kind of more formal relationship with the Syrian regime.
So you're not in favor of any of those?
No. I think that what has happened in the recent period is that the U.S. government, both President Obama and President Bush before him, have made claims about how evil one or another political force is. Al-Qaeda is so evil, we can never deal with them. The government in Iraq has to be overthrown. The government of Afghanistan must be overthrown. Gaddafi is so evil, he must be overthrown. And then somehow something else happens that makes that less evil than something else. In this case, you know, we're seeing now the ultimate evil of the regime in Damascus, in Syria, is not as evil, apparently, as ISIS. So maybe we should ally with the Syrian regime against ISIS. So when you start using these terms about the ultimate evil, it's not helpful. Number one, it means that the political pressure rises to use military force, when what we've seen is that military force does not work. There needs to be a political shift, particularly evident in Iraq, but in Syria as well. That's what needed to happen 3 years ago. It didn't happen. We're paying the consequence for that now.
What do you feel is a better approach to what is, after all, a problem that many Americans seem to feel has to be confronted in some way?
Well, I think the first thing has to be in Iraq, where the U.S. has more influence over the government. It's not the only outside actor. Iran these days actually has more influence in Baghdad than the United States does, even though we U.S. taxpayers are still paying the bills in Baghdad. I think one thing that means is that there should be a much bigger expansion to the talks underway with Iran. The nuclear talks seem to be going well. Those talks should be expanded to include some kind of a grand bargain that includes an arrangement on the kind of pressure to be brought to bear on Iraq. So that's the first thing. The second thing is to keep up the pressure on the Iraqi government. They've chosen a new prime minister designate, but it's going to be a long time before you have a new leadership of the military, new leadership of the other agencies, the intelligence agencies, the security agencies, that are responsible for the kind of repression that Sunni Iraqis are responding to when they embrace ISIS. That's what we need to do, is end the situation that causes ordinary Iraqis, who are not extremists, who are not terrorists, who don't support beheadings and these drastic approaches that ISIS has used, but who are desperately afraid of what their own government is doing. We need to give them some hope that it's changing.
But meanwhile, of course, there is some concern here domestically, and certainly in Europe as well, that many of these figures who are part of ISIS may return to the US or perhaps more likely to Europe and cause threats here?
You know, that's not impossible. Some individual may come back and carry out some terrorist act. You can't always stop every single act. But what you can do is change the political situation that means that those terrorists don't have any support. What we're doing now makes them get more support, not less. So I think that's what we have to start with. Is that going to prevent every young kid who for whatever reasons, feels so disaffected from their own community and goes and learns how to blow up a car? Is that going to prevent every action of that? No, probably not. We are a huge country. We can't necessarily prevent every single crime. We can prevent most of them, but we can't necessarily prevent every one. But we don't have the right by law or by morality to go around the world bombing other countries, killing other people, because we think that one day one person may come and commit some crime back here.
If President Obama, as is perhaps looking more likely, does decide to expand US airstrikes into Syria, what are you warning effectively that the effects will be?
I think that what we face in Iraq and in Syria is a situation where US bombing puts the US government on the side of repressive regimes. In Syria, the US has been saying for 3 years, this government must go. This government is evil incarnate. To go in now and bomb ISIS, which, whatever its own crimes, is also the strongest military opponent of the government in Damascus, puts the US on the side of that government against those it says that it is supporting. So this has created a huge situation where trying to respond militarily has simply mixed up the alliances the U.S. claims to care about. In Iraq, it's a similar situation. The Iraqi bombings by the U.S. will put the U.S. in a situation where Iraqi Sunnis will see it accurately as bombing in support of the Kurds and support of the Shia against the Sunnis. So it's making the U.S. a major player in these sectarian civil wars, which I think most people in this town even know, whether they admit it or not, is not going to be solved by U.S. military force. President Obama has said it over and over again. There is no U.S. military solution. He said it in Iraq. He said it in Syria. It's true. What he's doing now is violating every word of that.
Presumably, though, the Pentagon and the White House would say this isn't attempting to foist an American military solution. It's simply protecting U.S. interests in a what they will say will be a narrowly focused campaign.
There's nothing narrowly focused about it. Once you start bombing, you are at war. What happens when the first of those bombers gets shot down? There will be boots on the ground to rescue that pilot. Maybe sneakers because it's special forces. But there will be people to rescue a pilot. That's the beginning. You don't have control once you enter a war. So, you know, saying that this is narrow doesn't mean that it's going to stay narrow. It also means, what about the violations of international law? What does that mean to the U.S. ability to hold any other country accountable when we so blatantly violate it?
FSN's Washington correspondent Lorna Shaddock speaking to journalist, activist and political commentator Phyllis Bennis. This is FSN Reports. New figures from the World Health Organization show the Ebola outbreak in West Africa could eventually infect more than 20,000 people. Officials with the UN's health agency warned that the deadly outbreak, which has claimed more than 1,500 lives, continues to accelerate. Along with calls for a greater international response, the WHO says it will cost nearly $500 million to combat the spread of the disease over the next 6 months. Gary Alfonso is our Africa correspondent.
Well, the essence of that warning from the World Health Organization is that Ebola could reach, according to the World Health Organization, more than 20,000 people over the next 9 months. They're also warning it could cost anywhere between a half to a three-quarter billion dollars to stop the spread of the disease. We're not even talking of the current treatment of people infected with Ebola in places like Sierra Leone, Liberia, Guinea, and now also another case in Nigeria and also, as earlier reported, in the Congo. So they're also saying that the reporting of the disease continues to accelerate and saying that in the last 3 weeks, 40% of all cases reported Of the 3,070 odd known cases, 40% were reported in the last 3 weeks. And of course, we know that more than 1,500 people, in fact, the official number at the moment is 1,552 people that have died of the disease. That's the official number from the World Health Organization. They're saying that that number could grow to more than 20,000 over the next 9 months, and that a serious concerted effort by health authorities and security authorities, not only in West Africa but many parts of the world, is now going to be needed to fight this dreadful disease.
So, Gary, if this grim prediction from the World Health Organization actually came about, and we did see numbers reaching the heights of 20,000, does the affected region in West Africa actually have the medical capability to deal with those kind of numbers? Because they're already at breaking point from what we can understand.
I think the definite answer, and you don't need to have a very calculated methodology around this, the answer is no, they do not have the capacity to deal with this. The departure point from here is that the small clinics set up, even in cities like Monrovia in Liberia, can hardly deal with the new cases coming in every day, and people from rural areas moving towards some of these more urbanized centers where some of family members might have been affected, and them themselves obviously not sure whether they've been affected. And the World Health Organization sends a very clear message in terms of its what it says its roadmap to challenge this, and also in those West African countries, the one of the first things would be to try and strengthen the laboratory services in those countries to try and detect Ebola earlier, and also to perhaps take it more broadly to more rural areas. The second one would be to get more staff with expertise on the ground. That's a serious issue in these countries where many international agencies are withdrawing their doctors and medical experts for simple reasons that they cannot actually treat them effectively.
Unfortunately, there is no cure, there is no vaccine for the Ebola virus, but that hasn't stopped people searching for one. Where does that currently stand? Because Liberia was sent some experimental drugs recently, wasn't it?
Yeah, some samples of the ZMapp drug manufactured in California were sent to Liberia, but unfortunately, even those trial drugs not seeming very effective, one of the doctors treated with ZMapp in Liberia has died. So not completely effective, and many other pharmaceutical companies around the world staking claims of their drugs being perhaps effective in the dealing with Ebola. But in this case, perhaps what the World Health Organization is also looking at is to say that how does it itself and medical and health authorities in countries deal with those cases where people have recovered from Ebola with normal flu treatment and perhaps also some other vaccines, and that perhaps miracle drugs aren't the route to go in trying to find quick cures for Ebola. That might take a longer concerted effort, but perhaps Ebola now has the world's attention in trying to get a cure, and that even though it might not be as popular from a drug manufacturer's perspective, it is certainly a very important one to deal with over the next few months and years for all humanity on Earth, and not only for the people really badly affected in West Africa right now.
FSN's Africa correspondent, Gary Alfonso. And that's the Thursday edition of FSN Reports. If you'd like to contact the programme, you can always email us, reports@featurestory.com. That's reports@featurestory.com. And you can follow us on Twitter. We're there @featurestory. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside Rebecca Foster with The Bulletin. For everyone, with Feature Story news everywhere. Have a great evening. Goodbye.